This episode is brought to you by Hotels.com. I was traveling internationally last year. I was in Mallorca. I didn't know the island well. I said, let me head to the north, head towards the water. Let me go on Hotels.com and see what they have available. Something preferably on the beach, maybe even a gym. Not only did I get those things, there was a kids session with exercise, gymnastics in the water, pony rides, a train. It had everything, and I didn't even want any of those things. But at least I knew they were there, just in case I changed my mind. And now finding the perfect hotel has never been easier, thanks to the Hotels.com app. Whether you're looking for a family-friendly, right, all-inclusive, or a relaxing spa weekend, you can find exactly what you need and compare hotel prices, ratings, and amenities side by side. So start planning your next getaway and find your perfect somewhere in the Hotels.com app.
You could spend the weekend doing the same old whatever, or you could conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Shouldn't you be at work?
And Love. Oh, and Love, he's got a real chance now. Peter and Love.
John Walk will take the penalty. Up goes Dion Dublin.
Unknown goal from Ruddock.
Four back break here for Kiwabia.
Panister and Bruce in the queue again.
Bruce scores.
Goal leg. Hit leg. Hit leg over the top. Back now.
Now you know him better than anybody, probably. Do you back him to score quickly? Yes or no?
Yes.
Only Hutton.
No.
Hello and welcome to Quickly Kevin Will He Score Series 8 Episode 5. I'm Chris Gold. Joining me as always, Josh Widdicombe.
Hello.
And a man who went to his local hairdressers after lockdown ended with a picture of Jerry Francis and said, sort me out. It's Michael Mott.
I wish. Hello.
When I wrote that gag we just all enjoyed, it reminded me that in the 90s, one of my... Do you remember in the... barbers in the 90s all had like five or six black and white pictures of the same guys. Every barbershop everywhere. My mate in primary school, one of his brothers was one of those guys.
Oh, wow. Of course he was from Essex.
So his picture was everywhere.
Oh, wow.
What haircut did he have?
Oh, just, you know, where it's kind of a bit shaved on the sides and long on top.
A kind of feathered flat top, I remember being one of them. A bit like Gary Barlow in the early Take That videos.
Yeah, yeah. Was that a French crop?
No, French crop was kind of late 90s, wasn't it? French crop was like a number two around the sides and then kind of chopped into on top, I'd suppose would be the terminology.
When I think of 90s barbers as well, that wet look gel with the bubbles in it that's like a luminous blue.
Oh, yes, please. Yes, please.
And like the barber would just grab a fistful of it.
And it would set your hair rock solid.
I'm not sure if I've told this story in the pod before, but like around that French crop era, there was a rugby game in my school, like during like PE one day. And obviously I'd say 70% of the boys all had that overly gelled French crop look.
Yeah.
And it started pissing it down with rain. And the rain was so heavy and so torrential that it basically like diluted all the gel and all the boys' hair. And it was all dripping into our eyes. And they had to call off the lesson because we were all just like running around like, I can't see my eyes. Fewer people at the school nurse getting fucking third degree burn treatment for their
eyes. Wow, that is such a 90s sensation. That anecdote has really taken me back. You can taste it in your mouth when gel is running from rain into your eyes and your mouth. That is such a 90s sensation.
Well, we'll come to PE at school, or at least we will on the Patreon version of this episode, which has turned into a long debate over games you play at PE at school. But before that, Chris, before we move into the world of Danish long ball again, let's hear the 90s o'clock news.
From the headquarters of ITN, News at 10, with Chris Scull.
Mike Newell sent off, and how Steve Froggatt met his wife. A couple of big stories this week.
Yeah, big names, big stories.
Do send in your stories. If you see anything relevant, get it in. Hello at quicklykevin.com. Jimmy Lyons has done exactly that. Now, I don't know if you're following the Irish League at the moment. St Patrick's Athletic versus Waterford. It was last week, the 20th of April. 72nd minute, St Patrick 1-0 up. Mike Newell, assistant manager of Waterford, starts arguing.
The mighty have fallen.
So this is it's quite loose
assistant
here.
Assistant manager of Waterford.
Not even the manager.
Jesus, Mike. Come on, mate.
First English player to score a hat trick in the Champions League, and that's where we're in there.
Who can do better than that? Is it unless he's just local?
He's not local to Waterford, is he?
I don't know.
My main memory of Mike Newell is I wonder if I can find I bet you I can find the picture. Is he had an insane neck on his Merlin sticker one year. His neck was wider than his head. Here we go. Got it. First thing that comes up. We'll pop this on our Instagram. Do follow us on Instagram. Look at that. His head's actually thinner than his neck.
Oh, my God. Wow, look at that.
Do you think that's a Photoshop? Do you think that's an early Photoshop?
No, that's him.
At the point his ears come along, they disguise the fact that his neck's still further out than his head.
Yeah, were it not for his right ear, so sort of camera left ear, I'd say it's a good inch wider than the widest part of his face.
Yeah. I don't remember Mike Newell having such a strong jaw.
No.
He's got Desperate Dan jaw.
Yeah.
You know, you thought then, is it Photoshopped? I think it's not Photoshopped because if someone had Photoshopped it, when it was checked, they'd go, you can't put that out. Because Mike Newell's neck looks unrealistic. Okay. No one's going to believe that. His neck's wider than his chin. How is that even possible?
We'll put it on our Instagram. Do go on to it.
Yeah, we'll put that on Instagram. Anyway, look, Mike Newell's been sent off. Waterford assistant manager, 72nd minute. They're 1-0 down to St Patrick's. Do you want to know why he's sent off? This is the like real question of sport. No, but you never get it. Arguing about the colour of sock tape.
What?
How the mighty have fallen.
Arguing about the colour of sock tape. Like, I can't really get my head around that.
What, on a player?
It must be. But also, why are you arguing about that in the 72nd minute? Because surely...
Sub. It's got to be a sub who's got luminous sock tape.
Oh, hang on. I'm just reading the replies now. I'm doing some live research. Apparently, the team... This is a tweet from Gary O'Newlan. The team that he's assistant manager of tried to make a substitution. The sub was delayed as the player had shin-high white socks on over his blue Waterford kit socks. The fourth official made him put blue tape over the white socks before he was allowed to enter the field of play.
Blimey. It's like the USA. It's like a proper Jack Charlton USA 94 situation.
What is it with the Irish or people in Ireland getting angry over substitutions?
Well, exactly. Well, what is it with the English management in Irish games?
Oh, wow. There you go. Any more on Mike Newell? Any more 90s o'clock news stories? Do send them in. Hello at quicklykevin.com. But sadly, we've been talking about Mike Newell for so long, we've run out of time to talk about Steve Froggatt and how he met his wife. But we will get there eventually.
Oh, that's a shame.
We didn't allow for the neck, did we? Right. It is the electronic postbag.
I'm Jim Rosenthal, and this is the electronic postbag.
You've got mail.
I would like to start by... talking about substitute goalkeepers, because we discussed recently which substitute goalkeepers had the best career with the least amount of appearances.
Yeah.
So, Andy Gray, presumably not the Andy Gray, writes in, been catching up on Series 8 in the reference to subs goalkeepers carving out a career playing minimal games. Took my mind back to the Ghanaian goalkeeper Richard Kingson, who played one game for Birmingham City in 2007. He never played under Steve Bruce, then made only one appearance under Eric Black before Alec McLeish arrived and he never played for us again. By my calculations, he played 165 games in his 20-year career.
Jesus.
Wow.
However, and that's 165 league games, 20 years. However, what makes that even more incredible is that he got 90 caps for Ghana. Meaning more than a third of his career starts for international level.
That's crazy.
That's incredible.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, that's mad. But there must be, do you know what? That is impressive.
Well, I've got, do you want another one?
Well, I would say, I was just going to say, like 165, that's impressively low, but surely someone's lower.
Well, Chris Miller writes, It's hard to believe that after 8 series, there are still new facets of 90s football being covered.
You're telling us, mate.
The latest seemingly being the life of the second-choice goalkeeper. I'd like to present to you the epitome of the career bench warmer, Leicester and Liverpool's Peggy Arfaxad. In his 16-year professional career, Arfaxad played 39 games.
No.
What?
But in this time, he collected 7 winners' medals, all as unused substitute. That's 3 Worthington Cups, 1 FA Cup, a UEFA Cup, a Charity Shield, and a UEFA Super Cup. I challenge listeners to find a player with a better game-to-medal ratio than Peggy Arfaxad's 5.57 games per medal.
So 39 games.
39 wow. games, 7 winners' medals.
Jesus, that's insane.
I'm just, yeah, that's legit. That checks out. That blows my mind because I feel like Peggy Arfaxad is much a bigger 90s football character than that. Only 21 games for Leicester.
So we've also got, I should add, Josh Bryan presents us not just with Peggy Arfaxad. He adds another one that's worth mentioning is Stuart Taylor. Not as good, but 95 professional games in 19 years. So also bad. But Peggy Arfaxad or Richard Kingson currently lead the way.
That's incredible, isn't it?
Do you reckon they're just great guys? They must be.
It definitely plays a part, doesn't it?
Yeah. It takes a certain personality to be happy to do that. But not the kind of personality you would think would lead to you being a top sportsman.
Yeah, I think goalkeepers are just a different breed though, aren't they? Because I remember him at Leicester not being first choice, that it felt like he played a fair few games.
Yeah.
So in that period, if he's only played 39 games, the rest of his career, he must have played
Where is the rest of his career? Chris, have you presumably, you've said it checks out, so you've looked.
I've pulled it up. So yeah, he was at Leicester.
Don't want to hear about your personal life, mate.
So he played 5 games by the time he was 24 years old. So he joins Leicester in 97, plays 21 games, and then leaves Leicester, joins Liverpool. 2000-2003, 2 games. Goes on loan to Stockport in 2001 for 3 games. Coventry for 2 for 5 games. Notts County for 3 games. Marseille, no more games and retires there.
So he's played more than half of his career at Leicester, and that's only 21 games. How do you end up in the Premier League having only played 5 games in 16 years? There's just such a shortage of goalkeepers in the world.
That's
I remember him being quite good.
I do as well.
I don't know why how did I have an opinion?
One of the few goalkeepers as well to wear jogging bottoms.
Yeah, I always picture him in jogging bottoms. I've got to say though, Michael's right, that the real mystery is how he ended up at Leicester. Why has he not played 100 games before he's got to Leicester?
Yeah, I wonder whether like a scout has gone to watch another player and he just happens to play in that game and had an absolute worldie, and they've gone back and gone, I've just seen this goalkeeper. Like, I think I've found the next Peter Schmeichel, an untapped gem that is very difficult
to pip. How is he lobs?
Yeah, come on.
Sorry, Michael, you were doing it yourself. Nothing worse than slamming someone when they're about to do it themselves. It's a... I see you now as your personality so interlinked with that of Peter Schmeichel. So, yeah, maybe. Or maybe they went to watch another player and they just thought, that reserve goalie is knocking in some lovely crosses for the real goalie in the warm-up. He's carried that bag of balls onto the pitch absolutely without question for the warm-up.
Or, like, going back to our original point, he's there for camaraderie. That's why he's in the dressing room. So the scout went to watch a game, and then he looked down at the dugout, and the sub-keeper was just cracking everyone up. Morale on that bench had never seen such high morale on a bench. He's there doing magic tricks, impressions. The scout's like, just not watching the game anymore. We need this sub-goalkeeper.
But is there a world in which he's such a good reserve goalie they should have taken him to World Cups as just a reserve goalie? Because he's better at being a reserve goalie than a first-choice goalie.
He's the best reserve goalie.
It's like a specialist position. Yeah, like, who's the reserve goalie? Bernard Lama or whatever is it called? He's not going to be a laugh, is it? Well, he might be. That's unfair of me. That's really unfair of me. Last week we asked for the best moment when the Super League could have broken away.
Oh, yeah.
From the Premier League. A couple of options, both from 1992. We've got quite a few. The start of the 1992 season was the richest, but these are two I've picked for you. This is from Rob Hills. One could only imagine only 13 games into the inaugural Premier League season in 1992, the top six thinking that the domestic was over. And if it happened on the Sunday, the 25th of October, 1992, the European Super League would have had Barcelona, AC Milan, etc., plus Blackburn, Norwich, QPR, Arsenal, Coventry and Aston Villa. I think that would have been,
yeah.
I think that would have been all right, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
That's not too bad.
No? Yeah. Do you think that's any better or worse than Norwich, Coventry, Everton, QPR, Sheffield Wednesday and Blackburn? That's the dream ticket, isn't it?
Yeah. You sort of judge them by how far those big clubs have fallen between then and now, don't you?
Yeah, I mean...
It's like Blackburn, you know, they've won the Premier League, so technically they have as much right or more right to be there than, you know, Spurs do. But because they're so far down now...
Blackburn, Sheffield Wednesday and Coventry have all played in at least League One since that has happened.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'd love that to happen to some of the current top six.
But do you know what? With this top six, like, they never really explained their maths. What I would love to go, like, go, who are the top six teams over the last 50 years? Like, and they go in.
Yes.
Have an algorithm.
Well, the top six English teams, yeah, they would be Liverpool, Man U, Arsenal. Now, I wonder whether Man City have done enough in recent years.
I think you have to go, how many top division points have you had since 1960?
Since 1960?
Yeah.
Well, someone, if you'd like to do that at home, we would not say no. Now, shall we do a strange hill and then get on with the guest?
Let's do it.
Yeah.
This is from Sammy Craddock. Has uncovered a long-forgotten childhood memory in which I placed a certain player alongside giants of the game, such as Cruyff and Maradona. The Cruyff turn and Hand of God were regularly enacted in the school playing field, or tennis courts if it was too cold or wet. But it was in a training game for my local team that I first learned of this player's place in history. In the training game, I came up against a particularly tricky right winger. On a number of occasions, he got me with a combination of a double step over before tapping the ball through my legs and running around me. Each time he achieved this, a cry of Megson came from one of the watching dads on the sideline. Having consulted my Rossmann's football yearbook 94-95, I found a Norwich player with a decorated career who'd obviously rewritten the game in the 80s by developing the art of putting the ball through the opposition legs and bombing around them. Hence, the Gary Megson. The move was practiced with many old tennis balls at school, and I'd always hear the cocky kids shouting Megs as they successfully played the ball through a player. Everyone knew about Gary Megson. With hindsight, the bloke on the sidelines has obviously been shouting Meg's son. I must have called it a Megson on numerous occasions, but was never pulled up on it. I can't even remember a time when I started to associate the move with being a nutmeg and not affiliated in any way with Gary Megson. A part of me still hopes that on dusty African fields and crowded streets of Brazil, young kids still to find delight in successfully achieving a Gary Megson. All the best, Sammy Craddock.
That's great. I can't think of a player less likely to nutmeg someone than Gary Megson.
Yeah, it's kind of the perfect player, isn't it, the Gary Megson? There we go. Now, this week, possibly one of the most, you know, iconic clubs. If Manchester United were the club of the 90s, Blackburn were surely the club that were at their peak in the 90s and the club defined most by the 90s. This is Blackburn fan and comedian Ian Moore. If you want more of this interview, that was pun wasn't intended. These episodes, there's 15 minutes more of these episodes on Patreon. They also get them on the Friday rather than Monday. Plus, there are two extra Patreon episodes a month. That's the Steve Bruce Striker episodes with Ivo Graham. And also this month, me, Chris and Michael have been through our favourite 90s football magazines of the 90s. And I'm not going to lie to you, it was genuinely some of the most fun I've ever had on Quickly Kevin. Go over to patreon.com/QuicklyKevin. You will also get free tickets to the upcoming Zoom shows. But here is the brilliant Ian Moore. Today's guest is the best dressed comedian on the circuit, also the only comedian I know who commutes from France to gig. More importantly, when he isn't dressed as a mod or in a beret, he can be found dressed in a Blackburn Rovers shirt. Surely the football club of the 90s. Welcome, Ian Moore.
Thank you very much. Hello, Josh.
Hello.
Hello, everybody. How are you doing?
Very good. Very good. Blackburn. Oh, we haven't really... We've interviewed Graham Lassau, who obviously, you know...
He was there.
Ian Pearce as well.
Ian Pearce. So I was going to say, we haven't really touched on it, but actually, Ian, we've more or less covered it. So... We normally like to start with the same question to everyone, which is, have you ever met a 90s footballer?
Yes, I've met a few. I met quite a few. But probably most pertinent to this would be Chris Sutton.
Oh, yeah. Scary?
Yeah. Kind of. I think because I upset him. We were doing a pilot show and there was something happened and they were talking about people who would go on to be internationals and whether they really wanted it. And I said, well, Chris Sutton's in the studio. Why don't you ask him? Because he turned it down, didn't he?
Yeah.
It all went very silent in the studio.
Oh, God.
And I could say, because we weren't together. We were in a kind of gallery and the guests were behind us. And I knew it had gone really badly because Paul Ince was one of the other guests and he came up to me after the show, hugged me and called me the governor. So I knew it had gone really badly.
Is he? I know Ellis James are upset Chris Sutton as well on the Premier League show. Do you love him though for what he did?
Yeah, kind of. It just that whole season seems so utterly surreal, almost like a picture book. It's almost not. None of them existed. It is so out of context of what Blackburn have been in my entire life that it still almost seems like sort of playing fantasy football in a way.
Yeah,
I mean. It was wonderful, but I still even now kind of go, it didn't really happen, did it?
I don't think it did, actually.
Well, before we get into Blackburn, we wanted to speak to you about like how well-dressed you are. You're always so dapper. So who would you say, who do you look up to in 90s football or maybe beyond and think, they're well-dressed? Is there any inspiration from football?
No, absolutely not. Absolutely not. If you're looking for any kind of sartorial inspiration, football really isn't. It really is not the world to look at. I remember having a Shoot magazine, which I think was from 1976, or it might have been later than that. One of the first Shoot magazines, 78 probably, and Frank Worthington was in it, and he was deemed then to be the best-dressed footballer, and he just looked absurd. He looks like albino Dracula, the way he was. And it just didn't work. So I've never looked at football for anything like that. Same as role models. Don't go that way.
What about a continental manager? Like a Pep? Well, I think Pep's overrated as a dresser.
But well, he's not a dresser, is he? He's wearing leisure wear basically, but with this kind of top. That's all he's doing. And comfortable shoes. That's not dressing up as far. Nobody's wearing a cape. Nobody's wearing some kind of Edwardian frock coat on the benches. So, no, there's nothing there. I've never seen anything that approaches it.
Who was the guy that used to manage Exeter? Was it Paul Tisdale?
Yeah.
So Paul Tisdale.
Yes, and he wore that hat. He
flat cap.
He wore a hat. That was really good. He's got a hat on. That's all he's doing.
Where did you stand on Alan Ball in the flat cap?
He looked like he'd lost his whippet or something and wandered into the ground. I don't know. I don't think flat. That was the thing about, because I was watching some of the stuff about the 90s again this week and just how the Premier League didn't really, as the Premier League as we know it, start in 92. I don't think it started really until Wenger came in and taught Ian Wright how to eat broccoli. That was when the Premier League properly started. Before that, it wasn't really that much different, was it?
No.
In terms of managers and pitches and stuff like that.
Yeah.
The flat cap was a de rigueur with a lot of managers in those kind of days.
He wore it with tracksuit top, though.
Yeah, that's a strange combo, isn't it?
That's a William Hill look. There's nothing there.
So you grew up... Did you grow up... You'd support Blackburn. There was obviously now, bizarrely... There was a slight glut of Blackburn fans who must have been my age. I don't know if you two, Michael and Chris, had them at your school.
Had one.
I had one at my school. Yeah.
One guy converted from Spurs to Blackburn and then swiftly converted back by the end of the decade.
Did you have any on the Isle of Wight?
No, we were about 5 years behind anything culturally. So by the time that happened, it was done and dusted.
But I didn't mind people converting because your kit's so nice. I don't know if you feel like that, Ian. It's a great kit. Always has been.
It's very individual. I don't wear kits out. The only day I've ever worn a kit out was the day that Blackburn won the Premier League. That's the only time I've ever worn a football shirt outdoors. It was an interesting thing because for a couple of years after we won, there were kids, you know, like I'd be gigging somewhere in Cheltenham and there'd be kids wearing a Blackburn shirt. And it was just so unreal for somebody who'd never seen a Blackburn shirt outside of his own family before. Really odd.
So you grew up in Blackburn. Were you a good footballer?
I didn't start playing football in Blackburn. We left Blackburn when I was six.
Yeah.
And we moved to near King's Lynn in East Anglia. And I had never really considered football before that. But I was beaten up on my first day at school in King's Lynn because of my northern accent. The East Anglia people considered their accent to be far superior and let me know. And they were all into football. And at that point, I was just six, just turning seven. And the most important thing about football then was badges. I just followed a club because of their badge. Like I think my first team was probably Coventry because I was so intrigued by the fact that there was an elephant on a badge. I didn't understand, and that's the way I went for a while.
I remember when the American football was on TV in the 90s, and I supported the Cincinnati Bengals because they had the best helmets. And there is that kind of weird thing when you're a kid, like these little things can make you support a team.
Absolutely.
Did you support Blackburn though because you're from Blackburn?
I support Blackburn because I'm from Blackburn. Yeah.
What even is their badge? I can't even picture Blackburn's badge.
Rose, isn't it?
Yeah, it's the red rose, isn't it?
The language.
It wasn't even then. It was just you become, because I'm sort of separated from my family and cousins who up to that point I'd lived with, virtually because they lived in a house at the end of the road. So I became more sort of nostalgic for being back up north. So you just then start following your team. It was only then I realised they were rubbish.
Well, what year would that have been then?
That would have been 78, 79. Gordon Lee would have been manager. Noel Brotherston, you know, hopping between the second and third divisions, really.
So it's just, you've just chosen a kind of run-of-the-mill, middle-of-the-football-league team.
Well, yeah, but then I remember one of my earliest memories was actually going to see Blackburn play. I went to see them play a couple of times before we moved out of Blackburn. For some reason, one of my earliest memories is we're at Ewood Park and I just remember the opposition goalkeeper kicking it. That's all I remember from that match. And then another match was maybe a couple of years later than that and it was against Bolton. So it was a real, you know, fiery derby. Literally fiery because Bolton set fire to their stand.
Oh, wow.
So that was, you know, it was reminiscent of the Clásico, El Clásico there with fireworks.
And were you doing, were there big crowds and stuff?
No, not really. No, you know, very, very vocal, but not big crowds. But then it wasn't a big stadium. You know, that was all rebuilt when, at the end of the 80s, when Jack Walker started investing in it and started investing in the step. Before he bought the thing, he started investing in the rebuild of Ewood Park and was apparently on the sly paying some players' wages. Like, we had Ozzy Ardiles and Steve Archibald at the end of the 80s.
Wow.
Wow.
So, like informally, he's paying.
Yeah, apparently he was just, you know, putting it under the table. So
that's amazing.
We were like, Blackburn were like the MLS at the end of the 80s, where people were coming with fire.
So when did Jack Walker become formally part of the fabric of Blackburn then?
It was in 91, I think. Yeah, it would have been 91 because Dalglish took over in October 91, yeah.
And you were the bottom of what would now be termed, not the bottom, but near the bottom of what would now be termed
the
championship.
Yeah, struggling.
What kind of state's Ewood Park in at that stage?
Well, we're building a new stand already by then, but I was watching a match of the day of a cup tie, Blackburn versus Liverpool, January 91. So this is just before Jack Walker took over. And, you know, we had this last great hurrah on Match of the Day, which was properly badly edited at the beginning of the There is no, there's no kind of segue between the sound, the crowd sound at all. It's just, it goes from riotous cheering to silence and Motson talking all over it.
I think Motson talking all over anything ruins it. So that's,
there's no, nobody can remember anything John Motson said.
I agree.
It's just, you know, it's just a stream of facts and just, it's nonsense. And it's the modern prototype for today's commentators. But it's you know, silly. He scored. That's the fourth time he scored in the 57th minute with a win going at southeastern.
It reminds me, John Motson, of Alan Dedicote, the voice of the Balls, you know, the guy on the lottery, and he'll have a little fact about each ball that means nothing to anyone. And I don't mean that as a slam on Alan Dedicote. I mean that...
No, he's a lovely man. I work with Alan often, but I, and you know what? I'd actually prefer Alan Dedicote to be doing the commentary over Motson at any point.
So back to January 91. When Jack Walker took over, he said he was going to make Man United look cheap.
Yeah.
What are you going? Are you? I guess there'd never been like a City has been now. There's never been a big. There hadn't been a big takeover, I don't think, at that point. Could you see glory coming?
No. No. I mean, at that point, we were still in the second division, and we had David Speedy in our midfield. Glory days looked a long way off at that point.
What did you think was happening then? Did you think this guy's a chancer? This guy's just a bullshitter?
Well, the feeling was that because he was local, he really meant it. Mm. And nobody in Blackburn had ever made money before. We kind of revered him in how's he got all this? Where's it all come from? So if he's got this ambition, you kind of think, all right, well, you know, and the very Blackburn thing, yeah, all right, go on.
Was he a famous person in Blackburn before?
I think he was, yeah. I mean, my dad knew him, so he was. He was very, you know, he was a well-known figure.
Yeah. I'm trying to think if there was anyone before that did that kind of show.
Not locally. I've been trying to think of the same thing. The closest I can think of is Delia Smith in Norwich.
That's a long, yeah. There's a big gap, isn't there?
There's a big gap.
Between a drunken halftime rant and the Premier
League. What I mean is a kind of local wealthy personality who invests that much in the football club. I mean, that was always the history that, you know, you sort of local carpet magnate would invest in Rochdale and have an advert in the cinema. But that would be never anything like what Jack Walker did before.
Because no. In the 90s, there was some follow-up kind of failed Jack Walkers. So there was Michael Knighton at Carlisle.
Oh, he tried to start with United as well.
Yeah, he almost bought Man U. And then there was the guy at Darlington, whose name escapes me, who bought Tino Asprilla to Darlington and built. Did he build them like a 25,000 seater stadium or something? But Jack Walker genuinely achieved it, and also he achieved it when now. I mean, this. I don't mean this as a slight on Jack Walker. He would probably be a very financially poor chairman in the current Premier League.
Absolutely. You know, we wouldn't, for that kind of investment now, you'd be toward the bottom end of the Championship, yeah. Really. You know, and he didn't, apart from Shearer and Sutton, he didn't buy stars.
Well, no. Yeah, well, yeah, like it.
We had Stuart Ripley on the right wing.
Your first £1 million signing was Mike Newell, which just sounds crazy, even though you win the league a few years.
But then he scored in the playoff and got us up, yeah. You know, so he paid that money back.
So the biggest early signing you make, Kenny Dalglish coming in, and I think that must have been the moment you thought, whoa, because that is huge for a club like Blackburn then.
Well, that was nuts because, I mean, growing up and playing football, Dalglish was my hero. I didn't really, because you never saw Blackburn on television. So you didn't, your heroes were kind of remote in terms of Simon Garner, the all-time scorer, or Noel Brotherston, this tricky winger who looks like Andy Zaltzman, which is a bizarre combination. But you never saw your hero, your team's heroes on television. So Dalglish was always my hero. So then for him to come, not long after he left Liverpool, because that FA Cup tie I was talking about, Dalglish was manager of Liverpool in January when we played them in the cup, and he was then manager of us come October. It was just nuts.
So what did he do? Because Dalglish, to that point, like, he'd managed Liverpool. So it's not a similar job. It's not like he's, you know, if, like, I don't know, someone who'd worked their way up, like Brian Clough. Brian Clough had worked his way up a bit. But Dalglish had only managed a team that contained Ian Rush up until that point. He'd only managed John Barnes. So it wasn't like he was a nailed on, this guy is a managerial legend at that point.
Not at all.
Or is that unfair?
Well, up till then, the managerial legends had only ever been at one club anyway. Yeah. So to go to another major club, we weren't major. Sorry, I did get carried away.
You nearly said it without laughing.
But to go and try and do it at another club, it hadn't really been done. Nobody had been really successful and then gone to another club and said, we're going to be just as successful. I don't remember that.
Yeah.
Are there any precedents for that? I don't think. Well, you could say Ferguson, but Aberdeen, you know, I mean, even Blackburn were above Aberdeen, I would say, in many, many ways.
Yes. Yeah, I think, you know, we'll give you that. That's one we will give you. So Dalglish turns up. And does he start playing good football? Like, how does it?
I think he kind of gave, suddenly these sort of workman-like players up to that point suddenly had this all-time great.
Yeah.
In the dressing room going, you can do this. You know, you can do that and we'll put you here and don't worry about it if it doesn't work. He was so phlegmatic. It was almost like it was a different Dalglish to have been at Liverpool because I'm not saying it mattered less, but I'm saying that it mattered less. In many ways, he was so under pressure at Liverpool. This was kind of his relaxation, just sort of enjoying football again with this money to throw at this team. And it just changed people's careers. Ordinary players up to that point became really good players and knew what they were doing.
And when you get good in the Championship, is that the same team that Dalglish has made good, or is he already splashing the cash at that stage?
No, I think he starts to spend the money, doesn't he? As Speedy came in at the end of the 91 season, so they were starting to put the money in anyway. They were starting, because for up until that point, we'd always been, for about 3 or 4 years, we'd been pushing for promotion. And then that 91, the season that finished 91, we finished quite low, or we were struggling.
19th, according to my notes.
19th. You see, there you go. We were struggling manfully. And so I think they started putting money into it. Even in 91, like, we bought, you know, marquee signing, Bobby Mims. We got from Spurs.
Yeah.
And then obviously later on, he was replaced by Tim Flowers. Just kind of upping the quality in sort of incremental bits, you know.
Yeah, until Shearer, there wasn't really like a moment.
No, that changed everything because everybody expected Shearer to go to United.
Yeah.
Because he was so good and really so good. Everybody just expected him to go to a big club. That changed everything.
Before you went up, I need to go through this with you. So you looked certain for promotion. Do you know where this is going?
I think I know where this is going.
You looked certain for promotion, then you lose 6 in a row.
Yeah.
And then you, on the last day of the season, to get into the playoffs, you need to win at Home Park at Plymouth Argyle, which I was at. And we got relegated that day. We were managed by Peter Shilton. You were managed by Kenny Dalglish. What a pair of dugouts that is. And then you won the playoff final. Were you at the playoff final?
No, I didn't go to the playoff final. No, I listened to it on the radio at my student flat in London. I couldn't afford to go to that. Didn't have Sky to watch it. So, yeah, no, just listened to the radio. I remember listening to David Speedy hat-trick on the radio. That was just phenomenal.
Henry. We're now playing stoppage time at the end of the first half. Speedy! It's 1-1! Speedy's goal poaching instincts bring him his 21st of the season. He played more than 3 minutes of stoppage time at the end of the first half. Sellers chips it back in. Shilton stretching. They all miss it. And it's of 2 minutes. Plymouth must come back into this one if they're going to stay in Division 2. Speedy's on his way here for Blackburn. He's on his hat-trick. He beats Peter Shilton. It's certainly the goal which will take Blackburn Rovers into the playoffs. And David Speedy has hit a hat-trick.
Are you following most of it by not seeing it? You're just listening to it?
Yeah, wow. Absolutely. Yeah, just listen to it on the radio. And you know, I love radio sport anyway. A proper, decent radio commentator can bring sport to life in ways that I don't think television commentators need to. But that was also, for me, a downside of the 90s, because the main BBC commentator was Alan Green,
yeah,
who clearly was so full of self-loathing and hated football anyway. It would often be a chore to listen. That was my only option, was to listen to Alan Green, which is just...
He seemed, Alan Green, to be furious at his lot. Furious that he was stuck in the cold watching football with Mark Lawrenson.
You're a student sitting in this rat-infested hovel eating cold baked beans out of a can, and you've got this bloke sitting at Wembley going, oh, it's awful. It's awful here. They don't care.
But he was the soundtrack to the greatest period of your life.
Absolutely, absolutely. Him and Mike Ingham. Mike Ingham would generally do the first half of each half. He'd do the first 22 minutes. And then we'd all have to sort of brace ourselves for Alan Grimm.
That was when the BBC had the money to switch commentator halfway through the half.
Absolutely, yeah. They're not being shown to be profligate.
Playoff final against Leicester. Where were you for that?
I would have been, again, in my student digs. It would have been a Sunday, 92. So we were just before my finals. We were living in Finsbury Park in a flat next door to the World's End pub in Finsbury Park. And this was before pubs were open all day on a Sunday. So we were on our balcony looking over basically the tube station. And the landlord from the World's End next door, he came onto his roof terrace and said, what are you doing, lads? And we said, oh, we're revising for our finals. And he just brought up loads of crates of beer.
Come on. When you're on a roll, you're on a roll.
Oh, yeah. You know, and at that point you think, well, you can take your finals another time. This is Sunday.
Did you, like, you were living in London then throughout that kind of 90s period.
Yeah.
And did it feel like an exciting time to be, like, did your the most exciting time for you as a football fan, was it also an exciting time to be living in London? Or is that a complete myth put around by Stuart McConey and Jarvis Cocker?
There's these nostalgia fetishists. I don't remember it like that. I had no money to go out anywhere. I was given free beer by the landlord next door, and that was more than enough for me. It felt fun to be in London at that time, but I never went anywhere in London. The thing about big cities and London in particular at that time is that you were still putting your nose up against the window, looking at other people having a good time. You had to do all the Britpop stuff. You know, that happened in Downing Street. I wasn't invited.
Alan Green was
outside.
He was there moaning about it.
So we enter the glory period now, the Premier League. What a gilded existence. And straight away, Dalglish is doing the business straight away. You're clearly at home there. I think it's fourth you finish in your first season. Mad for a team coming up from the first division.
Yeah. And then second, I think, the next year.
You sign Alan Shearer straight away. Why did he not sign for Man U? And I mean no disrespect. Well, I do, I suppose.
I don't know why either. I have no idea. It doesn't make sense. It doesn't make career sense in any way.
I always thought, was Jack Walker just paying more money? Was he just paying bigger wages than everyone else?
I can't believe that they would be paying bigger wages for Alan Shearer at that point than Manchester United could offer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I don't see it. And also at that point, Hughes was kind of coming to the end of his career as well. It was the perfect replacement. So I don't know.
He did it again as well. He signed for Newcastle. It's like...
Yeah, but that was always obvious. That was more obvious than anything else, wasn't it? Because that's his hometown. You know, maybe he was just making incremental steps because Blackburn's slightly...
So you finished fourth. Did it feel like? Did it feel like the Premier League was like? How did that happen? I don't. That feels to me almost more bizarre than the winning the league. That you come up and you finish fourth.
But again, I think at that point, finishing fourth didn't mean that much then, did it? Finishing fourth didn't get you in the Champions League.
No.
So finishing fourth, it didn't. It's not the same cachet as you get today, for instance. So I mean, although it felt great, at any point you just thought, we're Blackburn. We are going to drop like a stone any time now. This is just all going to be over. So it felt fun, but it didn't feel real. It didn't feel like it could be sustained in any way.
Was that always? Were you always like, this isn't going to last forever? Or did you think this is the new normal?
No. Never thought it was going to last forever. I thought it was always we were riding high. We were a bit of sort of Icarus about this and just, you know, going, just taking it as far as it would go. But it was never, for instance, it never felt like, right, we're finally back where we belong. This is our birthright.
How much talk of that was there of the championships of the 1920s and how you're actually one of the...
There were very few people around from the last time that we'd won. I think the last time we won it before then was 1914. So I think even opposition squads were somewhat depleted at that point.
I was looking at the league that year. I mean, it says something about the Premier League. Not something, but like, as you say, about how it's not yet the Premier League as we know it now. So Man U won the league that year. And then the second, third, fourth are Aston Villa, Norwich and Blackburn. It was possible then for teams just to be... It was such a level playing field that it was just possible for a well-managed team with some good players to do well.
And look at the managers there as well. Like Villa would have been Ron Atkinson. Yeah. Norwich would have been Mike Walker at that point. That would have been Mike Walker and then us with Dalglish. It doesn't, like I said, it doesn't feel like the Premier League. It still obviously, it still is the old First League. It's just a change of name at that point. But it's... There's so many changes that it's gone through since.
Yeah.
Like the managers you look at in the year that the Blackburn won it, the managers around then were all ex-British players, you know, Jerry Francis. I wrote some of them down. Jerry Francis, Trevor Francis, Brian Nicol, Frank Clark, you know, just George Burley, just workaday British managers.
What an average collection of managers that just rattled off.
It just really is. It's Ray Wilkins, Joe Royal, Alan Paul, Phil Neal.
Well, I just kind of on that note, right? So you signed Tim Flowers, and then we come into this season where you win the league. You signed Chris Sutton too, David Batty, Graham Lasso, Stuart Ripley, Paul Warhurst. Like, with the benefit of hindsight, these aren't fantastic players. It's not like they were left afterwards and won the league. It actually made, like, looking back now, it's like, wow, how did Dalglish do that? Because this is extraordinary achievement.
It's almost fairy tale cinematic stuff, isn't it? It's the Dirty Dozen. It's escape to victory. It's getting a group of individuals who are not necessarily the best at what they do, but they're galvanised in such a way. And obviously, they made such a tremendous start to that season, and it fell away again, like we did when we got promoted. It fell away really badly.
Yeah,
as Ferguson said, what United need to win this league is a Devon lock, and we very nearly achieved that.
Was there like this feeling that, do you think that's unfair, like looking at those players, that in my memory and my mind Blackburn kind of bought the title, but actually looking at that, it's not like that. They haven't spent, I know that, you know, they've spent 2.5 million on Tim Flowers. They haven't spent, I know times are different, but they haven't spent 50 million on Kyle Walker. Do you know what I mean? This is...
Exactly that. And United made, who did they buy that season? Andy Cole, they bought in during the season. And our most expensive signing was Chris Sutton at 5 million. Chris Sutton?
From Norwich.
It's from Norwich. You know, it's not the same, is it? It's not like they've raided Europe and
no, it's not like when Man City suddenly signed Robinho, is it? It's a very different kind of...
Do you know what it is? It's very Blackburn. It's very East Lancashire. We're going to It's very kind of get a trade, lad. Don't have any dreams beyond what you can see on the Pennines there. We're going to do this. We're going to build bricks and do it, you know, do it properly like that. And, so, and he did. It worked. Because for whatever reason. I mean, we bought Batty, but Batty barely played in that season. We bought Sherwood, was it, the year before?
Yeah, yeah, Sherwood.
Tim Sherwood. He was our captain. He was our captain.
Is the amount of those players that didn't even really get in the England team? Do you know what I mean? Like, so you go, of that, the players that did what? Flowers wasn't the England goalie. Lassau was the England left back. So you give,
but then not even got, first choice really then, because that's Stuart Pearce.
Yeah, yeah. So you've got, then you've got Batty and Sherwood. Not really.
Sherwood wasn't an England player.
Ripley and Wilcox on the wings.
Not even discussed really in England team.
No, Sutton refused to play. but that was later on, wasn't it?
Yeah.
That was under Hoddle.
But also, how many times did these players go on to win the league again? I'm not sure any of them did.
Exactly. I mean, Shearer looks back on his career now, and Blackburn were his glory days. One of the greatest striker the Premier League has had, certainly British born. And Blackburn was his glory. And when he went back there with Newcastle, he got booed, which is nuts. I said, why would you do that? I can't understand football support.
Well, you won the league, but we've got to talk about. I mean, you nearly didn't. Like the end of that season, you almost come really close to blowing it.
Oh yeah.
Did you believe you were going to win the league at any point?
No, definitely not. There's no optimism doesn't reside in that part of Lancashire. I don't know if you've ever been there, but there's no hope for the future, and so you don't take these things on board. I never thought we'd win the league. I always assumed that United would catch us at any point because we were kind of a lot of players had never been at that level before. So there was a kind of fear crept in, I think. Only Dalglish had been at that level before. There was nobody else in the side who'd been close. And you could sense there was a jitteriness. You could sense that they'd kind of worked us out as well. For instance, if you look back at a lot of Alan Shearer's goals from that season, he is coming in late. Ripley goes down the wing, gets to the byline, can never, ever beat the first man with his cross. So it always deflects to the penalty area where Shearer was waiting because he knew that it was absolutely pointless going into the near post. So people kind of work that out. Other teams kind of work that out. So we just kind of run out of momentum towards the end. And that last day was just – I just expected – just United were playing West Ham, you know, and we were playing Liverpool.
Where did you watch that?
I watched that in it's a pub that no longer exists, but the Surrey Oval Tavern, because I lived in the Oval in South London at the time, and my wife and I went to the Surrey Oval. My wife hates football and would never go anywhere to watch. Certainly not go to a pub to watch football. That was the one day I went out wearing a Blackburn shirt.
And was it a Blackburn pub?
No, there wasn't a Blackburn pub. There's not that many Blackburn pubs in Blackburn. You know? There certainly wasn't one in South London. And I'm not making that cheap joke about United fans being down south, but the pub was full of blokes wearing United shirts. I was the only one there in a Blackburn shirt. And it had a hole in the back. It had an iron, like the shape of an iron hole. In the back, because my mum and dad had split up a few years before, and my dad just started ironing everything as if, you know, to kind of prove that who needs them. And he just burnt this hole in the back of the only Blackburn shirt I had, but that's the shirt I wore.
What did that morning feel like?
Oh, just so surreal. It felt a bit like the FA Cup when you were a kid, that you'd get up really early and you'd follow the coverage and the coaches and all of that. And obviously there wasn't necessarily that coverage, but it was that same kind of excitement and nervousness and adrenaline that, you know, this could be something that you've never experienced before. And the fact that even my wife came to the pub with me, with just everything, it was just bigger than it had ever been, you know.
And did you think going home that night that you'd just experienced the high watermark of Blackburn Rovers? Or did you think, I'll be back in that pub next
year? I felt lucky to be alive at one point because all the United fans started turning on me because at the end, when we'd won, I jumped up. I was giving it, was really, you know, just, I'm crying. I'm literally crying and go, we've won. And all these United fans started circling the table that me and my wife were at, and it was quite intimidating. And then just this huge group of Asian lads who'd been over the other side of the pub just came and just threatened all these United fans and moved them to the other side of the pub so that we could get out. It was beautiful, just a beautiful, you know, world moment.
And what did you do that evening?
I think I just got very drunk indeed. I knew there'd never be anything like that. Going back to your question, no, that was it. That was only, it was like, you know, it's like when Clark Gable won his first Oscar. It was like, there's only, sure as only hell, one direction I can go in now. And I knew that that would be our direction.
Really?
Did you?
Yeah.
And did you care? Yeah.
No. No, because it seemed so unreal to be there in the first place that it didn't matter. It didn't matter, you know, it was inevitable that we couldn't sustain it, I felt. It just would not happen. That other clubs, United especially, would not tolerate that, and they'd spend money, and they'd, you know, and that we'd won it. You know, part of the reason I think we won it was that Cantona was banned for their last four games. United, wasn't it? So there were little things that played in our benefit there, but it didn't matter. It didn't matter at all. I didn't want four in a row or anything like that. I wasn't greedy. I'd got that.
It starts going wrong really quickly, doesn't it? Like
almost 5 minutes later.
You say you didn't expect them to sustain it, but I mean, 6 months would have done, wouldn't it?
You knew it was going badly when Dalglish decided he was going upstairs, and everybody just thought, why? But you know what's going to happen. Why are you doing that to us?
So what was the reasoning? Was he just...
I don't know. I think he was spent in a way. I think he'd... Certainly towards the end of that season, the interviews he was doing, it was very cool and very, you know, nobody's worried and all of that. But I think he was spent, emotionally spent anyway, after, you know, all the stuff with Liverpool and then the Blackburn thing. I think he thought, I've proved a point. I've done it. You know,
yeah.
Don't have to do it anymore. In the same vein that with Blackburn in general, there's only one direction he could possibly go in. So why wait for that? Why not just get out when you could?
It's interesting as well. You said he kind of went in there just to kind of relax a little bit. And then suddenly he's turned you into one of the top teams in England. And there's the pressure that comes with that. If you'd went there for a holiday, suddenly it's not a holiday.
No, exactly. The pressure returns, doesn't it? You know, once you've created this. And so why not? Why not leave at the top? What, you know, what other managers can leave at the top? That was why it was a strange decision when he went, you know, went to Newcastle and then went back to Liverpool. It just...
Yeah. Do you have very fond feelings towards Kenny Dalglish then?
Well, I loved Kenny Dalglish when I was a kid because I was number seven when I played football and he was everything I wanted to be. And also later, in later years, and we're coming to Chutney here, Josh, so just hold fire for a second. I did a TV show with the guy who's on BBC Radio and Kelly Cates, and I was banging on about Chutney, as I inevitably will at some point.
Of course.
And I gave, and I gave Kelly a jar of Chutney. And then this was just before Christmas. And then just after Christmas, I was doing that show again. And Kelly came up to me and she said, my dad loves your Chutney. He was raving about it on Christmas Day. That's the high point of my career.
What flavour was it? What type of Chutney?
I think it was spicy apple and walnut.
Wow, Kenny's got quite a refined taste.
I couldn't see his replacement Ray Harford going for that.
Harford's got Branston Pickle written through like a stick of rock, hasn't he? So was Ray Harford his assistant that then just got given which is never really... Well, I suppose it works at Liverpool back in the day, but...
It did.
It didn't feel like you were...
We won the title that day. The first person that Kenny Dalglish hugged, because obviously we were playing at Liverpool, was Ronnie Moran from the old Liverpool boot room days, which was a nice touch, I thought. You know.
Yeah. He didn't hug Ray Harford, though.
I know. I think he was already down the pub, Ray.
So what kind of... Did you sign in? Like, did Walker stop putting money in? Or was it like... How does it...
I was trying to work that out, and I couldn't... I don't think there was. I don't think there are any more signings. I don't remember any major signings. Lars Boheman, maybe.
There's big money down the road, isn't there? Like when Hodgson comes in, you get, I think, $7 million for Kevin Davies, and I think Nathan Blake is always the one that sticks out for me for $4.2 million, which is mad.
Yeah, there was money down the line. I mean, we started buying. Who do we buy? Martin Darling.
Oh yeah, that's of another. Course.
No, I mean, but we started again. We kind of went back to that place where we were at the end of the 80s, where we were buying people way past their best.
Yeah,
rather than people who were going to be hungry and offer something. So it was always inevitable.
It feels like that season after you just kind of rested on your laurels or something. But you just got off to a bad start, and and then you're in the bottom half, and like, how do you suddenly become so shit?
But Ian, I wanted to ask you a specific incident. David Batty and Graham Lasseau, like, the implosion is so visible on the pitch as well. Yeah. How do you feel as a fan when you're watching two of your own players fighting like that?
Well, first of all, you kind of go, this is inevitable. This is Graham Lasseau and David Batty essentially sharing a dressing room together. When was it not going to kick off at some point? It's like Sean Bean coming up against Helena Bonham Carter. You wouldn't have them in the same room. And Lasseau always said that it wasn't, there was nothing specific on the night, but it had been building up through training that Batty was just constantly on his back, constantly telling him he's not good enough, in the wrong position, not putting in the effort.
Blackburn have shown little fighting spirit in the Champions League this season, and even tonight they got it wrong. Amid unprecedented scenes, teammates Graham Lasseau and David Batty came to blows with only 4 minutes of the game gone. And only the intervention of other Blackburn players prevented a full-scale brawl. Amazingly, neither was booked, but both will now surely face a heavy club fine at the least.
But they weren't the only people who were fighting that night. It's often forgotten that Sherwood and Hendry nearly came to blows as well on the same night.
I didn't know that.
This isn't playing in Europe. This is a stag night.
So what was going? What is that? Just what's happened? They've won the league. They're doing badly in the European Cup, but teams always do badly in the European Cup in the 90s. Like, what's gone on?
I just think it was the release of the pressure of winning it. And they'd lost that hunger, a lot of them, but some of them still had a hunger. I mean, David Batty, I think, because he wasn't really involved in the Premiership winning team, then maybe he was, you know, more fired up than other people. And if he saw any sort of lapse in other people, he would be on their back. It's so, I don't know. Why does it fall apart like that? They didn't have Dalglish, so they didn't have that figure in the dressing room that was so respected for their achievements and their ability. You had Ray Harford, who, you know, a tough guy by all counts, but, you know, not respected necessarily in footballing terms. So it was just, like I said, it was inevitable. I just thought they might wait more than 3 months.
I said the big moment for me when you know the writing's on the wall is when Alan Shearer leaves, because that's your man. How did you feel when your talisman leaves like that?
Well, I mean, I thought fair enough. You know, he got us to a point where we were never going to get without him. He, you know, he didn't do it single-handedly, not by any means, but without him, we wouldn't have got there. And he wasn't going to United. He wasn't going to another near rival in that sense. He was going home.
Yeah.
So you kind of thought, well, fair enough.
Maybe I haven't got that steel. Even if I was a footballer, I don't have that competitive steel. But, maybe it's just being schooled at being a Plymouth fan, but still not. So there was, you know, when there was rumours in the summer about Plymouth manager Garrett, who's quite well respected in the lower leagues, maybe taking a Championship job, and there's fans getting angry. And in my head, I'm going, well, I could totally understand that as a decision were that to happen. You can understand that this is these people's lives and careers, and they're not living. Alan Shearer didn't grow up giving a shit about Blackburn Rovers. Like, do you know what I like? And I don't know if you have it with West Ham, Skull, but I don't bear people ill will when they leave my club in the way that loads of people really, really do. Like you say, Shearer getting booed, or it blows my mind, really.
Yeah. I think West Ham are at the scale where we're just on the cusp of bearing ill will.
For everything.
You've been on that cusp an awful long time. More like a bungee jump over the precipice.
Do you have it with Man U, Michael? Do you bear it?
No, but I think it's a very different beast when you support a club at that level. The only time I think it slightly irked me was with the Rooney thing, because it felt like he was leveraging for a better deal. It's only been players that have been sold that I've thought, oh, I'm sad they're gone. Like when Yap Stam.
I suppose no one leaves Man U to further their career.
Well, unless they go to Real Madrid, unless you're Ronaldo or something like that.
But you didn't bear Shearer. Who replaced Shearer? Did they buy anyone, or did they just re-promote Mike Newell?
It must have been Newell brought back, because Sutton wasn't long behind, a couple of years maybe, because he went down. He was in our relegation team.
There's a mad kind of thing that then happens that season, which is Ray Harford gets sacked. That's not the mad bit. And then I just can't believe they sacked Ray Harford. he got sacked. And then there's an agreement to bring in a man probably more or less unknown to all of us at that point, apart from as one of the people you occasionally hear about on Gazzetta Football Italia, Sven-Goran Eriksson. Which suddenly felt like, oh, that's quite an exciting thing to be happening at Blackburn.
But again, it was one of those ridiculous things that you hear that you go, well, that's not going to happen. That's never suddenly, you know, Ray Harford hasn't been pushed aside for Sven-Göran Eriksson to come in. That doesn't make sense.
And you're right.
None of that makes sense. It was like in 2010, I think, when there were rumours that Ronaldinho was going to sign for Blackburn. You know, you just somebody's bored in a rumour mill somewhere, and it never happened with Sven. Obviously, it never happened, and I don't think it was ever going to happen. Yeah.
And then Roy Hodgson comes in.
Yeah.
And how do you feel about Roy?
Well, here's the thing, right? Roy has done very well at every club he's been at and did okay at England. But he's awful at Blackburn and pretty rotten at Liverpool. There's a kind of downbeat element to Roy, which I think works at a club that has a level of optimism. And as Blackburn has no level of optimism, it kind of two downbeats meet in one, means we were dragging each other down.
Yeah,
something just not there was. It was never going to galvanise a club that was in trouble. I think is what I mean. It wasn't the fervour there. There was, and obviously, you know, he's okay. But what we knew about him when he came in was that he'd been manager of Switzerland. Nobody, all right, had been at Inter and all of that, but everybody just remembered him from Switzerland, and they were dull.
Yeah,
you know. All Brian Moore ever said about Roy Hodgson was that he spoke four languages. Well, to be honest, that's not necessarily the main requisite for managing Blackburn at that point.
No, that's not going to galvanise Kevin Davis. 7 million for Kevin Davis.
He was shocking as well, wasn't he? He did really well at Southampton, rubbish at Blackburn, and really well at Bolton. There's a trend emerging.
Well, out goes Hodgson. And I was so excited about your next appointment, Brian Kidd. Because there was always a suspicion at the back of my mind that maybe Brian Kidd was the man, and maybe he was actually pulling all the strings in. So he gets this opportunity at Blackburn. Were you as excited as me?
Yeah, completely believed my own hype that like you, he was the main factor behind United's success. And I actually said that. I did a gig with Sir Alex Ferguson, a PFA lunch, where he would be doing a Q&A and then I'd go on and do a set after him. And I had to sit with him all through the meal next to him. A really nice man, and you know, and really sort of down to earth considering. And he obviously didn't necessarily want to be there, but he just kept saying to me, are you going to eat something? And I went, I don't eat before work ever. I don't, you know. I went, oh, all right. Do you want a drink? You want a drink? I mean, I don't drink before I go on stage. He went, but you do want a red wine, because I brought my own. And he reached under the table and got his own bottle of red wine. Man's an absolute legend.
So what did you talk to him about?
We talked about Blackburn quite a lot, because this was at the point where this was some years after, but Steve Keen and the whole Venkies thing had been going on, and he said, you know, what a rubbish appointment that was, and how it was all a bit murky and all of that. And then we talked about Blackburn and who he'd liked, and he always admired Shearer and Jack Walker and Kenny Dalglish and all of that. So it was a really...
Did he
was
have
a really...
any kind of strange view? Like, obviously, did he have any, like, hot takes that you weren't expecting on people? Was he like, the heartbeat of that team's Mark Atkins? Or was there like...
it was nothing that left field.
And what, can I ask a question about the wine? Was he... Did he get it out and put it on the table? Or was he pouring it under the table?
He clearly was not prepared to drink the wine that was being supplied by Old Trafford conference facilities.
But was he doing it surreptitiously?
No, not even that. I think, you know, he, at that point, when would this have been? 2016, maybe?
It's recent.
Fairly recent. He couldn't care less. And he kept saying, who's the guy, who's the PFA guy? Gordon Taylor. Former Blackburn, obviously, and he called Gordon Taylor over, and Gordon Taylor leans in on Sir Alex's shoulders, and he says, "Alex says he won't drink, and he won't eat." And Gordon Taylor stands there and goes, "Well, let's just hope he's funny, Sir Alex." Shall we just-
oh God!
No pressure. Absolutely no pressure coming in. But I said that because Sir Alex said, he said, "Look, I'm not hanging around once I've done my Q&A. I'd love to stay and watch her." Of course he would, but he had some workmen at home, and they'd been there for months. It was their last day, and he wanted to give them some cash for the weekend. Genuinely. Absolutely. Legendary man, right? Just and I went on stage and I said, "Oh, I'm glad he's gone," because I didn't want to tell him that when Brian Kidd took over, we all believed that Brian Kidd was the master and the string puller. Genuinely thought that. That is why there's no optimism in Blackburn, because the minute it puts its head above the parapet, optimism, it gets kicked off massively.
Brian Kidd was voted Manager of the Month straight away. I remember thinking, I was 100%, not that I cared, but I was 100% drinking the Kidd Kool-Aid. Like, I think the nation believed, I don't know why Brian Kidd had got such a hold over the nation as Alex Ferguson's assistant.
Even now, in my head, I think he's a great manager. Even though he failed, I still can't believe he's not great.
I think because the whole sort of 90% of the footballing world was so anti-United and anti-Ferguson because of that, they were all willing him desperately to do well, to show that he and for United to drop and that there'd be some kind of balance come up. And it was never, I remember there was a match towards the end of the season and we played United and we needed the points. And Brian Kidd had laid out this team. And in the interview after the match, Alex Ferguson, in his scalpel-like way, just said, "But he didn't play that lad there. Now, if I was needing points, I'd have played that lad there." It was a very strange tactical decision. And just killed him off. Just killed him.
In his autobiography, so Ferguson was very bitter. I think that Kidd had left. And in his autobiography, he criticises Kidd because Kidd wanted to buy John Hartson rather than Dwight York. And then I'm gonna read you a quote from his autobiography, which is, "I saw Brian Kidd as a complex person, often quite insecure, particularly about his health," which is a strange quote. And then Kidd responded by saying, "I believe Walt Disney is trying to buy the film rights to his book as a sequel to Fantasia," which is such a pathetic put out.
Somebody's written that for Brian Kidd. You just know that.
Michael, as a Man U fan, what are your feelings on Brian Kidd? And were you believing?
No, because I think as a United fan, you know. Although that might be in hindsight, because we've had a whole series of assistant managers who I think got too big for their boots and probably thought that they were more important than they were because they run the training. Like, Ferguson rarely runs the training. But what that club was at that time, that dynasty, was built on him as the figurehead. It's so much more than just going, "Oh, you're out of position there." It's about the respect he commanded from everyone at that entire operation. But I think with Kidd, the same with sort of certain people, like there are people in business and sport like Michael Jordan, Phil Knight. The thing about Fergie is like he adored Brian Kidd. He absolutely adored him. But the moment you're not with me, you're against me. Like it's literally that simple. Like a history, loyalty, all of it's out the window. You're by my side or you're the same as everyone else. And that was the fortress and that sort of mentality that he built. The moment Kidd left, it's like, okay, nothing matters. You're an enemy now.
Yeah.
And that's how he ran that club for, you know, 9 on 30 years.
Brian Kidd's an odd one though, isn't he? Because he was part of that team that won the European Cup. He should be exalted as this absolute legend, you know, second in command to Ferguson, the winning the trophies again. And yet he's just kind of, it's almost like Trotsky and Stalin's, like he's kind of airbrushed out a little bit.
Yeah, that's a very, I mean, that's quite a harsh comparison.
but Trotsky never paid $4.5 million for Ashley Ward from Barnsley. So.
That's fair enough. He would have got the arsenic treatment a lot earlier.
with Brian Kidd, what we haven't touched on is occasionally you'll be watching Match of the Day and there'll be the Man City bench and he's still there. Like a kind of,
you forget, don't like, you?
Fucking hell, he's still doing it.
I always think there's a glitch in the Matrix when I see that. Because I'm like, Brian Kidd must be 100 now. How's he still going? And he's getting younger.
And he's working for Pep Guardiola. He's not working for Manuel Pellegrini. He's working for someone that you imagine doesn't put up with fools. Do you know what I mean? Pep Guardiola's, I mean, I'd love to know whether Brian Kidd's ever mentions his brief foray into first team management.
It's so two different eras, isn't it? It's like Trotsky going in the cabinet of Obama or something like that. It's like, what? How is this? This isn't right.
Do you reckon Pep ever turns around to him on the bench and go, what would you do? We're losing 4-2 to Leicester here. What would you do? And Brian Kidd goes, I'd put Gary Flitcroft up front.
Only in a crucial European game it's totally winnable. Can I take you through some of Brian Kidd's signings? Ashley Ward, 4.5. Jason McAteer, 4.25. Matt Janssen, 4.25.
Yeah, he was great. He was great.
Was he?
Yeah, Matt Janssen was an exceptional player. And he was our top scorer, I think. I can't remember what year. But he was on the cusp of an England call-up. And then he went to Italy on a weekend, crashed a moped, and lost some motor ability. So he never played again. It's a very, very sad story. But he was a great player, Matt Janssen.
God. Well, I feel bad now about finishing on Egloftenstad, 4.25 million. What happened there?
Yeah, what happened to him?
He did come back, though. He did play lower down. But never the same talent that he was. No.
Yeah. Did Brian Kidd then take you down?
Yeah. And then he was still there, I think, for the start of the next season, but sacked by Christmas. And then Tony Parks did one of his, I think he was caretaker manager about 6 times over the next 7 years.
There's a nice synergy to the fact you ended the decade where you started it.
I quite like that. I quite like that. Do you know? Because there's people often say that football's a kind of roller coaster. But there wasn't a roller coaster because it didn't go up and down. We just went up and then straight back down again. We were kind of a hot air balloon that got shot. And we.
So Souness comes in and actually does quite a good job.
Yeah. We won, this wasn't in the 90s, but we won whatever the League Cup was called, I think, in 2001, which was very bizarre because I was listening to that. I don't know if you ever did the gig, Josh, in Durham. If you did Comedy Store Manchester on a Thursday, Friday, Saturday, you'd then go and do the Durham gig on a Sunday night, but you were driven over in this stretch limo. And you turned up to Durham in the stretch limo with just these people looking at you and hating you already.
Why are we being driven over in a stretch limo? Where was the money coming from?
That's what the Comedy Store booked for us. And it was just absurd, just utterly absurd. But I remember listening to that final in the back of a stretch limo.
And then a year later, sadder kind, but kind of just a circular kind of journey, Jack Walker dies. And yeah. That must have been such a huge thing for the town.
Massive. Just because you knew that that was all gone, because he'd always made it clear that he'd left a kind of was it a trust fund or a trust set up to look after the club, but you knew that it wasn't the same level of funds in that, because they were not necessarily fans in the way that Jack was a fan. So
was it his kids or what? Like, how did it?
I don't think it was. I don't think it was the kids. I can't remember now, but they were more business orientated in the sense that they weren't going to throw money at it because it was the love of their life as a club. They were looking at it going, let's just sell this and keep what money we have left. And get the hell out as quickly as we can, you know. But I don't think that happened until about eight years later. But yeah.
And Jack Walker must just be heralded, like, more than Shearer or Dalgleish, as like just this the greatest figure in the history of the club, right?
It's like the Wizard of Oz. You know, it's like the statue of him outside the ground, and people still talk about him now. And, you know, it's one of these things, it's a bit like the French Resistance. Apparently he knew everybody, did Jack. All these people will come up with anecdotes about meeting Jack. I think it never happened, but, you know, it's a huge figure, absolutely massive.
Yeah, it's an amazing journey, but I am obviously now Blackburn aren't in as good a position.
No.
Would you... I mean, I know what I'd answer to this, but would you trade what happened with the league, but then with Venkies, or would you prefer to be safely in the Premier League like Burnley are now?
Oh, no, I wouldn't trade that. I wouldn't trade that at all. It was that brief moment in the sun. And a lot of other Blackburn supporters, you know, if they're thinking right, they'd go, what we've got now is, I think, as best as we could hope. We are still functioning as a club. There's so much competition for clubs in the Northwest that for us functioning at a decent level, you know, halfway up the Championship, that's fine. Just stay there. Just don't go bust. Don't go up. Don't go up and spend a load of money. Just stay where you are and just exist. And that's fine, because we got that thing, you know, 25 years ago, we had that.
Do you feel like, in a weird way, like, as a fan, like, I always think, I kind of convinced myself, oh, it's good that England didn't win the World Cup, because when that happens, I've still got that to come. But do you feel in a weird way like you've completed the computer game of football? You've had that moment and now you're just kind of, you know.
Yes, I do. At a club level, I do, yeah. I can enjoy football for, you know, I don't feel, I've never been overly partisan. I can't be tribal. That's not how I see football anyway. But, I lived through that. And it's that, and that's, like I said before, that final day of being in the pub and all of that that came with it, and the end of the season when we might lose it. That's just something that I don't need to go through that again, to be perfectly honest with you. It was fine. It's fine. I'm done now. And as for the World Cup thing, I'm French now. I got genuinely through. I got my French nationality came through 2 days before the World Cup final in 2000. Oh. I never thought I'd ever see my nation win. Amazing.
Do you follow, like, you've got two sons, is it? Or
three sons.
Three sons. And how old are they?
19, 15 and 11.
Are they French football fans, English football fans? How does it work?
No, they're very much English. My eldest son is a United fan. My middle son is a Chelsea fan, and my younger son's an Arsenal fan. So if Blackburn has taught them anything, it's try and pick winning teams.
And do you go to football in France?
Yeah, but a quite low level, because my club over here is Tours, and they were Ligue 1 5 or 6 years ago, but through various financial irregularities, shall we say, they just keep getting demoted every season. They just get demoted another. I think they're currently playing under 15 football in the Loire Valley. That's how badly they've been demoted now. So they were a great club, but that's my team. So we do. My middle son plays at a high level, and he was at a French football academy last year. So I see a lot of local football.
And would he represent England or France?
He would always say England, but I wouldn't let him.
we always ask one final question of our guests, but actually I've got two final questions for you. The first of which, Paul Warhurst, centre-back or striker?
Striker.
Wow.
Really? Gotta be striker. It was quite useless as a centre-back, wasn't he? That's right away. Up front.
And our second last question. If you could turn back the clock to January 1st, 1990 and relive that decade all over again, would you?
Yeah. Yeah, I definitely would. Yeah, not just for the football, for many other things, many mistakes made along. I'd never start stand-up again, I'll tell you that much. I'd get a decent bloody job. Get a trade, as my dad always
said. Get a job at Jack Walker Steelworks.
Absolutely.
Ian Moore, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you very much. Hope you enjoyed reliving the greatest period of Blackburn's history.
It's been great. Just doing the research was quite emotional, I have to say.
That was Ian Moore. Guys, did you like Blackburn in the 90s?
I didn't, for obvious reasons.
I'd love to ask this question. Was there anyone in your school who started supporting Blackburn?
Yes, there
out of
was.
Nowhere?
There was
How
a
many
kid.
People?
To my knowledge, there was one kid who supported Blackburn. That was it. And also, to my knowledge, he was the most boring person in my year. Blackburn does strike me as quite a boring club. Do you know what I mean? Awful thing to say, isn't it?
I remember no one at my school, but I remember playing at youth football and a player on the opposing team turned up in that half and half, like blue and white Blackburn shirt. And I think he said something like, oh yeah, no, like my granddad's from Blackburn or like some bullshit like that. But I bet that guy's regretting his life choices now.
Oh, no, he's not because he supports Man City.
Exactly. There was one kid in my school and he went from Spurs to Blackburn, which really kind of stuck in my craw. But he did wear, I was quite exciting on unclosed day when this kid would wear a Blackburn shirt. Because to see a Blackburn shirt up close, I do think it is the best kit of the 90s. It is a beautiful kit.
What?
Yeah, it what? Really is. The one they win,
it's not even top 10.
The one they win the Premier League in is a fantastic kit. McEwen's lager, isn't it? You've got the little, the string up top. The blue and white looks fantastic. It is an electric kit. It's a really good blue.
In honour of Blackburn Rovers and to calm down the situation.
I'm livid.
Yeah, I bet you. Yeah. I am going to conduct our final quiz. All the questions will be between the two of you. They're on Sir Kenny Dalglish. Three questions each and then there'll be a tiebreaker if not. Chris, question one. Name the two clubs Kenny Dalglish played for in his career.
Celtic and Liverpool.
Correct. Michael. Can you name three clubs that Kenny Dalglish managed?
Liverpool, Blackburn, Newcastle.
Correct. He was also caretaker at Celtic, but I think that is that is tough. Next question. In his career, Chris, how many league titles did Kenny Dalglish win? I will give you one either side.
How many league titles?
In his career with Celtic and Liverpool.
Oh, with Celtic as well. Oh, my God.
God, that's really tough.
He's got one either side.
All right.
Can you tell me how long his playing career was?
Yes.
And that might be an easier way to
Yeah, that's fine. That's acceptable.
How many seasons did
he? His playing career was from 1969 to 1990, 21 years. How many of those years ended with him winning the league?
I was going to go with 17, but I think that could be high. Do you know what? I'm going to go for it. I'm going to say 17 league titles.
You think he won the league 17 out of 21 times?
Jesus, that's high.
Is that high?
I thought the answer of 10 was quite impressive, but...
But Celtic, I thought, if you've got Kenny Dalglish in your team, you're winning your league every year. And then that Liverpool side he's in is one of the most dominant. So four seasons not winning the league... That is high, actually. That is high, isn't it?
Yeah, that is high. Right, high. Michael, I'm not going to give you one either side because it's a much lower number. How many European Cups did he win as a player?
I think it's three.
Correct. It's 2-1 to Michael. Okay. Kenny Dalglish moved from Celtic to Liverpool in August 1977. I'm going to give you £100,000 either side of his transfer fee. It's between zero. It's between zero and £1 million to stay in the game.
Oh man, It's not going to be a lot. I don't think it's more than half a million. I'm going to go 350,000.
It's 440. He's got the point. It's an unbelievable moment.
Lovely.
No one was expecting that. Okay, Michael, to win it, Kenny Dalglish played 102 games for Scotland. I'll give you three either side on the amount of goals he scored.
I mean, that feels tough.
I wouldn't even know what to guess here.
He's played 102 games, and he's one of the best strikers in the world. So
I don't know. See, I don't know how prolific he was. I don't know whether he was a sort of Cantona type where he scored a lot of important goals but wasn't banging, 25, 30 a season every season. I'm going to say... What have I got either way?
Three. You did... Chris was talking you into five, but then actually I just stuck with three either way.
Okay. You say 102?
Yeah.
Caps. Okay. Okay. One in four is a good record. I'm going to say 26.
Oh, my God. It's 30. Yeah, you've one off.
Oh, come on. Oh.
So...
No,
the tiebreaker. In 2018, Kenny Dalglish was knighted for services to football charity in the city of Liverpool. He already had an MBE. In which year's New Year's Honours list did Kenny Dalglish, had he achieved enough to get an MBE? Chris, you can go first.
I'd go early 90s. I'm going to go 92.
92. Michael?
So, is it a closest
scenario? Closest, yeah. And
Oh, mind you, I don't remember him being called MBE in the 90s. Because they would have to say it, wouldn't they? Or did they?
No, it's kind of your...
No, I'll stick my guess. I'll stick my guess. 92.
Then I'm going to play a tactical earlier guess and say 1990.
It was 1985.
Oh.
Really?
Yeah, isn't that amazing?
Well, that's really early.
So, Michael, what would you like to play us out with?
In honor of the late Jack Walker, who we all know made his money via steel, which is a form of metal.
Yes,
I'm going to pick a 90s metal track. I'm going to pick November Rain by Guns N' Roses.
And that wraps up this week. Robbie Slater, see you later. Thank you.
This episode is brought to you by State Farm. You might say all kinds of stuff when things go wrong, but these are the words you really need to remember. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. They've got options to fit your unique insurance needs, meaning you can talk to your agent to choose the coverage you need, have coverage options to protect the things you value most, file a claim right on the State Farm mobile app, and even reach a real person when you need to talk to someone. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.